This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN. A conspiracy theory that reads like a political thriller, and it's enveloping the Vatican.
For the Pope to immediately remove him makes me think the Pope had some sort of material that was so egregious that he felt he could make a decision without any other process.
That's ahead on the show. Also today, a deep dive into the Saudi Kingdom's project to export hardline Islam. Now, could a former Vatican official have paid more than $1 million to tilt the 2018 sexual abuse trial against Cardinal George Pell? In April, the High Court unanimously overturned Cardinal Pell's conviction, and he's now back in Rome. But extraordinary allegations have now appeared in the Italian press against Cardinal Angelo Becciu. 2 weeks ago, Pope Francis sacked Becciu for alleged financial misdeeds. Unnamed sources now claim he funneled 700,000 euros to Australian bank accounts to influence the trial. Becciu denies any interference. The lawyer for Cardinal Pell's accuser says her client never received any money. But George Pell's former barrister Robert Richter wants an investigation. Joshua McElwee is Rome correspondent for the Independent newspaper, the National Catholic Reporter. He's been following the intrigue.
So what's happened here is that a newspaper in Italy, the Corriere della Sera, published allegations, kind of unfounded, that Cardinal Becciu, who had been this figure at the Vatican Secretariat of State and known to be something of an enemy or a kind of a polar opposite of Cardinal Pell, the Corriere alleged that while Cardinal Becciu was in the Secretariat of State, he had sent this sum of money to Australia to some unnamed account, possibly in various different transfers of different amounts. The report did not indicate how they had come upon this information, who their source might be, or even give any sort of indication of how reliable it might be. So I want to see more information. It's a huge claim to make based on a very small amount of facts.
That said, Joshua, Corriere della Sera and La Repubblica, the other newspaper that apparently also published these allegations, they're both mainstream newspapers. So are people in Rome, and especially people in the Vatican, taking this seriously?
There's always a bit of skepticism, I think, about Italian newspaper reports, even if they're in major newspapers. It has attracted headlines here, certainly. As your listeners will know, Cardinal Becciu recently met with Pope Francis and apparently was asked to resign his position as the head of the Vatican Sainthood Office. Cardinal Becciu also was asked to resign his rights as a cardinal, meaning whenever there might be a next conclave to elect the next pope, Cardinal Becciu will not be part of it. It's obviously a huge matter for a cardinal. So this is a big story in terms of what's going on with Becciu. There are lots of allegations about how he might have inappropriately spent money while he was in the Vatican Secretariat of State, serving as what is essentially the Pope's chief of staff for several years. But there are so many different allegations coming forward at this point, it's hard to know exactly what could be truthful and what is kind of fancy. And the Vatican, I think, hasn't really helped matters in that they have not said what allegations specifically the Pope was considering or were levied against Cardinal Becciu to have the Pope want him to resign. It was quite an astounding moment in Rome when that happened. We got a little note from the Vatican press office late in an evening in Rome, about 8 p.m., very unusual, with no further details. And so I think we're waiting to see now if there will be follow-up from the Vatican, perhaps from the Vatican judicial system, calling for Cardinal Becciu either to give testimony or even himself to be indicted or stand trial. But at this point, we're waiting for much further clarification from the Vatican.
I've been reading various references to the idea that the allegations about this alleged bribe may have come from Monsignor Alberto Palasca, who was very close. I think he was Cardinal Becciu's deputy for a long time, and he is now officially under investigation. What's being said, perhaps, about his role? Because he was very close to Becciu. Apparently, according to reports, he was able to monitor overseas transactions.
Yes, so this Italian, Alberto Palasca, and Cardinal Becciu worked together in the Secretariat of State. Obviously, Becciu was, I think, Palasca's superior, so there was an unequal power relationship there. If we believe the Italian media reports, Palasca is upset with Cardinal Becciu for kind of not defending him earlier or for kind of standing up for him when he was brought under the suspicion by the Vatican judicial authorities. I'm very skeptical about these reports. I mean, the first hurdle for me would be no one knows the name of the alleged victim in Cardinal Pell's case. So it would be hard for me to believe that someone at the Vatican would be able to find out that information and then be able to determine to send that person money.
And as I pointed out in the introduction, Cardinal Pell's accuser has, through his lawyer, denied receiving any money. A lot of threads, though, are being pulled together here. Whether they come together naturally is another question, but a lot of threads are being pulled together here. The resignation or the effective sacking of Cardinal Becciu, the return to Rome of Cardinal Pell having been cleared by the High Court of the charges which saw him go to jail, and now the recalling to Rome of the Vatican envoy to Australia, Adolfo Tito Ilano. Do you see any pattern here? I mean, is this all just coincidence, Josh?
I think we've got to be very careful about wanting proof of each thing. Cardinal Pell has come to Rome, apparently in his own explanation, to set right his affairs. He had to leave Rome quickly about 3 years ago to defend himself in that court case. He has not been back since. The Cardinal has an apartment in Rome. He obviously has his possessions here. He has other things to tie up, I'm sure, in terms of his life in Italy. And he himself has said that he had planned this trip before everything happened with Cardinal Becciu, before Becciu and the Pope had their meeting, and before Becciu was effectively asked to resign. And so I think we're seeing a confluence of events here, and I don't know that any of them are connected.
I wonder whether, though, we might not see Cardinal Pell as a witness in any kind of Vatican trial of Cardinal Becciu.
We don't know exactly what the Vatican prosecutors are considering in their own determinations. Obviously, there is this issue with Cardinal Becciu. The clear thing the Vatican has been investigating has been this apparent property deal over a property in London that Cardinal Becciu was part of, some sort of investment scheme to help with a development project in London that apparently went sour and cost the Vatican a substantial amount of money. We know that the Vatican prosecutors are investigating that and may be bringing forward a case that could involve Cardinal Becciu. At this point, it's pure speculation to wonder whether they might call forward Cardinal Pell as a witness in some way. We don't know exactly how long Cardinal Pell might be in Rome, and I imagine it would be difficult for him to be a witness once he returned to Australia.
One thing we know that is not pure speculation, because you documented it in great detail, was this very tense meeting between Pope Francis and Cardinal Becciu. What was actually said in that meeting? Because I believe the language on both sides was pretty blunt.
We know that Cardinal Becciu and Pope Francis met in an afternoon last week, and that shortly after that meeting in the evening, long after most Italians had had their supper, we had a short two-sentence statement from the press office saying the Pope had accepted Cardinal Becciu's resignation as the head of the Vatican Sainthood Office, and had accepted his resignation of the duties and rights connected to being a cardinal. We are waiting for some sort of further explanation from the Vatican or even from the Pope about what led the Pope to make this decision so quickly. Obviously, this is a rather enormous decision. It could have been understood if the Pope had asked Cardinal Becciu to kind of step aside or to maybe step down from his position temporarily as he was investigated or as some trial went forward. But for the Pope to immediately remove him makes me think the Pope had some sort of material that was so egregious that he felt he could make a decision without any other process. Cardinal Becciu has given a press conference the day afterwards saying that the Pope raised questions of financial misdealing and embezzlement, particularly with regards to how Cardinal Becciu in the Secretariat of State may have sent money to a charity run by his brother on the island of Sardinia, where Cardinal Becciu is from. The cardinal said that there was nothing improper about that. He had sent the money for use with this charity. Even though his brother was at the head of it, it was for the good of the charity and for nothing else. Cardinal Becciu said the Pope told him bluntly that he had lost trust in him, and that's why he was making this move.
Yeah, you quote the cardinal as saying, "I was white in the face," about his meeting with the Pope. If that was one very uncomfortable meeting that occurred with Pope Francis recently, there was another tense meeting. Just to broaden this, Josh, what happened when US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo requested an audience with Pope Francis recently?
Yeah, Mike Pompeo had come to Italy as part of a several nation tour in Europe last week. He was coming to give a presentation at an event hosted by the US Embassy to the Vatican. Obviously, Mr. Pompeo has expressed quite clearly his displeasure at the Vatican's dealings with China, particularly with regard to a deal the Vatican made with Beijing 2 years ago over the appointment of Catholic bishops in China. Mike Pompeo, rather extraordinarily for a U.S. official, had published an article in a conservative right-wing Catholic magazine in the U.S. expressing the U.S.'s disagreement with the Vatican's move. Apparently, Mr. Pompeo asked for a meeting with Pope Francis while he was here in Rome. Cardinal Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, told journalists last week the Pope had declined that meeting, which is not all that surprising, particularly because the Pope has a long tradition of not meeting with political officials in the lead-up to any sort of national election. So obviously in the U.S. we're dealing with our presidential election, and the Pope doesn't want to be seen to be endorsing any sort of candidate or any sort of policy in that time frame. So instead of meeting with the Pope, Mike Pompeo met with the Secretary of State, Cardinal Parolin, and they apparently had a fairly frank exchange of views. I believe the Vatican called it cordial, respectful, but obviously it seems that the Vatican and the U.S. have different opinions about how to engage with China.
Joshua McElwee of the National Catholic Reporter. Now, while all this controversy was breaking, Pope Francis signed a major new statement aimed at healing the economic and social divisions caused by COVID-19. We'll look at that next week. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. In-depth research from the Pew Center tells us large majorities of people in Muslim countries want more democracy and oppose religious violence, especially groups such as ISIS. Pew also shows that Muslims in Western countries, including the US, are patriotic towards their adopted homelands. But for 40 years, Saudi Arabia has been exporting a purist, even authoritarian form of Islam that blends the Wahhabi and Salafi traditions. Journalist Krithika Vargor investigates this history in a new book, The Call, Inside the Global Saudi Religious Project. And as you'll hear, Krithika reveals the Saudis have had some surprising allies in their quest.
4 years ago, I moved to Australia's neighbor, Indonesia, to work as a journalist. And Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim majority country. And I was reporting on religious fundamentalism and extremism. Through my reporting on these developments in Indonesia, I came to realize that a lot of the key actors and institutions behind religious fundamentalism in Indonesia had some kind of Saudi connection, whether it was the leader of the Islamist guerrilla group or these kind of the Islamist political party. Everyone had graduated from some kind of Saudi-linked institution or otherwise had spent time in the kingdom and so on. And that's why I decided to investigate why this was happening a little bit more coherently as a journalist. And I realized it was part of a much bigger program that dated back to the 1960s of systematic outreach, not just in Indonesia, but to dozens of countries around the world, both Muslim majority ones and ones with Muslim minority populations.
As you say, in Indonesia, it's been a long-standing influence by the Saudis, but I did get the impression that that interest had been intensified after the tragedy of the 2004 tsunami. And in fact, Saudi money was instrumental in rebuilding.
That's absolutely right. So the hardest hit part of Indonesia by the tsunami was Aceh, which is a very, very conservative province on the westernmost part of Indonesia. You know, suffered over 100,000 casualties, and a Saudi charity campaign quickly set up shop in Aceh right after the tsunami. And they still have an office as of 2018, which is the last time I was there. They set up orphanages, helped rebuild houses, and built schools, and accompanied these charity efforts with their missionary program, which included scholarships, but also preaching the Salafi kind of Islam. To some extent, I expected to see this when I went to Aceh. What I didn't expect was that the Acehese people put up a resistance to this kind of missionary activity, even though they were so vulnerable after the tsunami. And Aceh is actually one of the places in Indonesia with a very vibrant clash between Salafi or Wahhabi elements and their local Muslim traditions. It's both an example of how Saudi charity works in tandem with its missionary activity, and an example of how not every place that's the recipient of Saudi aid takes 100% of what they have to offer.
You describe Saudi foreign policy, which is deeply entwined with religion, as being, and I do like this image, like throwing spaghetti against a wall and you see what sticks. I mean, that is a very good image. Give me an example of this sort of scattergun strategy that the Saudis employ.
Returning again to Indonesia, it would be impossible to pinpoint one thing that they did there. They really tried everything all at once, starting from around 1965. So not only did they build a brick and mortar Saudi university in Jakarta, which is the capital of Indonesia, but they also created a religious attaché's office, which is associated with the embassy. And it's kind of like a diplomatic post that is supposed to oversee missionary activity. But they also funded the former prime minister to distribute Saudi money as he saw fit. They also funded the creation of schools. They also put preachers on their payroll. They also gave scholarships to study at university in Saudi Arabia. And they also did charity things like the Aceh tsunami relief. So all of these together is part of what I would call the Saudi sphere of influence in Indonesia. And it wasn't as kind of single-minded as you might think, because it had a very broad range of efforts. So when we talk about the Saudi campaign, it's not just one thing like they created terrorists. It's that they tried to do a lot of things, including educational diplomacy and supporting people getting higher education where they might not have otherwise.
The central idea of the Saudis' religious outreach is this idea of dawah. Now, just explain, what is dawah? It's powerful, but it's quite simple.
Dawah is just an Arabic word that means to call or invite, and it means the call or invitation to Islam in practice. So in some ways, a duty of every Muslim to do dawah in the way that they see fit. So it could be as simple as living your life as a good Muslim could be your dawah. But in the Saudi nation state example, Saudi dawah meant systematically trying to spread their state brand of Wahhabi Islam through a variety of different programs around the world.
And it's an important point that you bring out about this clash between indigenous forms of Islam that have often sort of merged with local cultures, have been very healthy expressions of Islam, and what the Saudis have been trying to export.
Absolutely. So in all three of the countries that I took as case studies for this book, Indonesia, Nigeria, and Kosovo, there were very strong and very different religious traditions before Saudi dawah started from the 1960s onward. Sometimes this took the form of Sufism, sometimes it's animistic or syncretic forms of religion, and sometimes it's just a more casual or less literalistic approach to religion in the case of Kosovo. These traditions, when they came into contact with the very literalistic Saudi brand of Islam, there was often conflict engendered by that. Sometimes it was violent, sometimes it was just ideological, but either way, you don't come and bring such an extreme ideology like they were doing and not ruffle some feathers.
Yeah. Well, you don't just bring the ideology, you bring dollars. Do we know just how much money the Saudi government has thrown at religious export, as it were, over the past, say, 20 years, 30 years?
The numbers are very hard to pin down. in part because a lot of internal financial flows are reported only to the monarchy and they're not like necessarily externally accountable. But by one account, the Legacy Foundation of King Fahd, who was a key Saudi monarch, estimated that they spent about $1 billion in Dawa between 1982 to 2002. Again, it's self-reported, but I think that's a good ballpark in the sense of how much they were investing in this global project.
Krithika, the Saudis embracing this purist expression of Islam have had a rather interesting partner in their project. What role has the United States played in partnering with the Saudis?
It's a great question. I'm glad you asked. Some of the peak periods of Saudi missionary activity coincided with the United States' Cold War against Russia and their global anti-communist campaign. So in a lot of countries, especially in Asia and Africa, Saudi and U.S. interests went hand in hand. The Saudis wanted to counter communism because they felt like it was a threatening ideology to Saudi leadership of the Muslim world. And the U.S. was threatened by communism in other countries because of the so-called domino effect that they feared would happen. So the U.S.-Saudi relationship is very old. It dates back to the discovery of oil in the Arabian Peninsula in the 1930s. And it's been a very special but strange relationship over time, forged almost exclusively between elites, between presidents, between business executives. There's not a great deal of cultural fellow feeling between Americans and Saudis. But this has been an ironclad relationship and almost a central fact of U.S. foreign relations for almost the whole past century. So in part, the carte blanche that the U.S. gave Saudi Arabia and the implicit backing that they gave was crucial to their missionary campaign. And although the U.S. would later come to see Islamic terrorism as, you know, an enemy in the so-called war on terror, during the Cold War, people like Henry Kissinger actively encouraged the Saudi export of Wahhabism because they thought it would be sympathetic to their own anti-communist projects. Mm-hmm. So what happened in the 1990s and then especially after 9/11 was huge whiplash.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West, I'm speaking with Krithika Vaghore. She's the author of the new book, The Call, Inside the Global Saudi Religious Project. We know a lot because we've discussed it quite a bit over the past almost decade on the program about the United States effectively creating the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and that also being an anti-communist project. But I was fascinated to read about this outfit, which doesn't directly involve the US, but it was called the Safari Club. Tell us about the Safari Club.
That's one of my favorite episodes of Cold War history. It has a whimsical name, but not so whimsical aims. It's named after the ranch in Kenya owned by the famous Saudi arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi, where the US and Saudi officials and leaders from other countries like France met to plan anti-communist escapades throughout Africa. They were very concerned with beating back communism in Africa. And, you know, this kind of fell apart after the Iranian Revolution. It was only a few years that it held together. But this was a part of the high watermark of US-Saudi cooperation on the African continent. And they most feared kind of like spillover effects of initially like Arab socialism, but also just communist movements and revolutionary movements in sub-Saharan Africa. There are a lot of stones left unturned. Adnan Khashoggi, of course, was part of the very prominent Khashoggi family. But this is exactly the kind of elite cooperation that we saw between US and Saudi during the Cold War.
Yeah, wasn't there some shady French count involved also in the Safari Club?
Yeah, and I think he was very interested in places like Angola, for example. And the thing is, with regards to what the Safari Club did on the ground, we know the general picture of places they were acting, such as Somalia, but in order to get the full picture, we need to see some files declassified on the US side, at least.
We know about the Saudi influence in Asia. We know about the Saudi influence now in Africa. We don't quite know much about the Saudi influence in Europe and particularly in Kosovo, a breakaway state from Serbia, not recognized by the United Nations, but it is recognized by the US. One figure leapt out at me about Kosovo and its relationship to ISIS. What is it?
It was a big surprise to me, too. The Saudi campaign in Kosovo was one of the last or like the most recent vintage of big Saudi campaigns. It was, I would say, one of the last ones before 9/11. So it started in December 1998, towards the tail end of the Yugoslav wars, when Saudi aid started supporting Kosovars and continued up until, you know, through the 2000s. Part of that time, Kosovo was administered by a UN body, and there was very little, you know, central oversight. So there were a lot of Saudi preachers doing their thing and spreading Salafism on the ground. But it didn't really become, you know, a topic of international concern until about 2014, when a surprising number of young Kosovar men started emigrating to join ISIS. Kosovo is populated by ethnic Albanians, who are historically a quite secular people. And Yugoslavia, of course, was a communist state, was not very religious. And the question was, where did this come from? How did so many young people in Kosovo emigrate to ISIS? Actually, the highest number per capita in all of Europe, higher than Belgium and France. And the answer, in large part, you know, in my research, is because Salafism spread like wildfire right after the fall of the Yugoslavia, thanks in part to Saudi Dawah, which was instrumental in rebuilding the religious life of Kosovo after the Yugoslav wars. When we think of Kosovo independence, I think most of us would think of US, because the US led NATO bombing is what led to its independence, and the UN administered it. But neither the US nor the UN were really looking out for like Kosovar's religious life, and they left that playing field wide open for Saudi and Gulf actors. The consequence of that is that so many of the most influential preachers and imams in Kosovo got scholarships to study in Saudi Arabia, and what they teach is a very Saudi-inflected brand of Islam. And that is why Salafism spread within less than two decades so fast within this small country that people started becoming jihadists.
Yeah, well, an interesting example of the purification that the Saudis insist on was the destruction of certain Ottoman heritage, because the Saudis told the Kosovars, and this is, you know, the Ottomans, probably one of the most successful Islamic periods in world history, that it wasn't Muslim enough.
This idolatry and destruction of tombs and monuments is one of the central tenets of Wahhabism. In some ways, you can compare this instinct to maybe like Calvinism, if that makes sense as an analogy. It's very anti-iconography. So the Wahhabis in the original 18th century and context destroyed some of the most important heritage sites inside Saudi Arabia. They almost destroyed the Black Kaaba, which is the direction in which all Muslims pray around the world. That's how against monuments they were. Luckily, they didn't get to destroy that World Heritage Site, but that is the approach they take. So when they got to Kosovo, they encouraged the destruction of these beautiful Ottoman graveyards and rebuilt these mosques that had been shelled in a kind of very bland Gulf style instead of the more regionally specific Ottoman style. So a lot of cultural heritage of Kosovo and the Balkans was lost in this process.
Let's talk about Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, a man who's tried to present himself as a liberal reformer. I guess you're not sold on that image.
I'm not sold on this image. A month or so after I sold my book proposal, Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in a Saudi consulate. I was worried at one point when I started writing this book, maybe it'll become irrelevant because of Vision 2030. I was very quickly disillusion from that particular prospect. MBS is a lot of things. He is a modernist. He is a, you know, reformer. I believe that he is sincere in some of his intentions. But the way he's carried out his actions is callous at best and egregiously awful at worst. And in terms of Wahhabism, he has made a big show of arresting clerics and claiming to present a new moderate face of Saudi Islam in the world. So it's obvious that he's very sensitive to the reputation that Saudi has developed as this kind of fountainhead of extremism. But when you look at the people he's actually put in jail, the people he's actually reprimanded, it is not the most ideologically fervent Wahhabi clerics, but it is the reform-minded people, the people who've called for tolerance of religious minorities, people who called for human rights liberalization, who MBS has put in jail. He is not some kind of anti-Wahhabi. He is very much still a Wahhabi. He is a member of the House of Saud, and his family has a pact dating back to the 18th century with the Wahhabi clerics, and he very much still has to uphold that pact, even if he says things to the contrary. In terms of the promise of Vision 2030 in modernizing the religious establishment, I'm not super hopeful. But despite whatever he says, the one thing that I do think might change the Wahhabi campaign and has already is the fact that their oil revenues are not what they used to be. So whether or not they want to continue the Saudi project, they're no longer as flush with money as they were in the late 20th century. So that has necessarily handicapped a lot of their projects around the world.
Krithika Vagur, she's the author of the new book, The Call, Inside the Global Saudi Religious Project. It's part of a Columbia Global Reports series of books. Krithika, thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
And that's the show for this week. That's the Religion and Ethics Report. You can catch us anytime on the ABC Listen app or your smart speaker. Thanks to Muta Tadias and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.